T-Mobile has invested billions to light up America's largest 5G network, from big cities to small towns, including right here in yours. And great coverage is just the beginning. Right now, families and small businesses can save up to 20% versus AT&T and Verizon when they switch. Visit your local T-Mobile store today.
Plan savings with 3 lines of T-Mobile Essentials versus comparable available plans. Plan features and taxes and fees may vary.
It's time for MLB Pitch, Hit, and Run, the official youth skills competition of Major League Baseball. Host a local event and give kids in your community a chance to compete in the Pitch, Hit, and Run finals at the 2024 MLB World Series. Sign up for free at pitchhitrun.com.
Tom Giordano on Talk Radio 1210 WPHT.
Hey everyone, welcome in. Our virtual speaker series continues, and tonight, right there in front of me and in front of you and taking your questions along with me, is Bill O'Reilly. Bill, congratulations. I was just telling my producer, I don't think he believed when I showed him the pocket of the book, the number of books you've written. What's the total? You probably know, down to the book, right? A book sold by Bill O'Reilly.
Probably this about point. 27 books, counting the kids' books and the series that we put out, Legends and Lies. I'm busy. My hand hurts, Dom. It hurts.
Well, I wanted to start with this book because you said something, and you said it in the book, and I wrote it down the other day, and I wanted to wait until now. You actually visit it. You got to visit to see these places to get a sense of it. I don't remember ever asking you that with your other books. I don't sense that you were to Germany and whatever for the Nazi book. So where did you visit, and take us through that, why that was important?
Well, Martin Dugard did the Southwest. I have been to all these places before, by the way. I walked the Custer Battlefield in Montana. I was in the Badlands extensively in South Dakota. Certainly been in South Alabama, where Fort Mims is. Dugard went and walked the Apache territory where Cochise was. I haven't done that, but I've been there. But he really walked the mountains, the superstitious mountains. I've been to every state, all 50 states, and every major American city. So it helps when you're describing the terrain, number one, because we want to get everything right, and also the feel of it. So when you go to the Dakotas, particularly South Dakota, and you see the Crazy Horse Monument a couple of miles away from Mount Rushmore, carved into the stone, and this big head of Crazy Horse, I mean, it really makes an impact on you. You can visualize what happened. But of all of them, the Custer Battlefield, which is a national park, is the best because they have laid out where all the U.S. soldiers were killed, and they have little markers where Custer was. And you can see how they got surrounded, and the Indians came at them from all sides, and they just didn't have a chance. They couldn't get away. So it's, you know, when you walk those sites, and I'm sure you've done this too, in Gettysburg near Philadelphia,
right.
You walk
right.
That battlefield, you get a feeling. And so that helps us in writing vivid text so we can take and put the reader there.
Yeah, I wanted people to know a lot goes into this. It's the choice. Yes, Dugard is brilliant, the guy that you've worked with. But it's your eye, ultimately. And I always tell you, what I find in these books is, I thought I knew a lot about this stuff, but I find nuggets all along the way that I drill down. They make me go and then want to read a full book on that nugget that you don't have time for. Why this book, though? This is the biggest panoramic view. That's the thing that's important. In one book, you get a sense, I think, of one of the three biggest things that made America, moving westward. It is in our DNA. It is one of our biggest foundational principles.
And it's something that Americans don't know about, which is kind of shocking. But public schools, they don't want to have anything to do with Native Americans now. That's way, way too dangerous because it's not politically correct and you can't really say what happened. It's like slavery. Very few public schools are engaged on really what happened there. So the American who lives in Philadelphia or New York or Boston. Well, how did we get to San Francisco? I mean, how do we get 3,000 miles across this continent? And the story of that is what Killing Crazy Horse is all about. How this country was forged from 1813 to 1890. The Indian Wars lasted 77 years, Dom. That's how many conflicts and battles and skirmishes there were. And it was every part of our nation. And we open in northern Florida, southern Alabama, and then we end in northern Idaho, eastern Washington state. So you can see that this huge canvas, but what I'm able to do, and I do believe it's a gift from God. I do believe that. I could cut through the fog. I cut through it in my news analysis on BillO'Reilly.com, and I cut through it on the page. I can distill what's important, and I can put you there. I can put you at the Little Bighorn, or the massacre at Fort Mims, or the demise of Tecumseh, or the Apache campaign in Arizona. I put you there. And that's a talent. I've never taken a writing class in my life, ever. And it was just given to me, and I'm using it, and I'm so humbled that we have 17 million copies of my books in print. By far the most successful nonfiction book series in history, pardon the pun.
Where did it come from? Did it come from God or Dugard or somebody say, killing, killing. It's like plastics in The Graduate. Killing, that's it, that's the title.
Here's something really interesting, Don. When I first started this series, I went on the CBS Morning News and Nora O'Donnell interviewed me, Irish lady, Catholic, just like I am. And she goes, where'd you get the idea from this? And I said, middle of the night. And this is God's honest truth. I would never say anything that isn't true to Dom Giordano, by the way. I want everybody to know that. So I'm talking to O'Donnell on CBS Morning News. And I said, middle of the night, I woke up and Abraham Lincoln's in my head. Why? I didn't do a story on Lincoln that day. I hadn't read a book on Lincoln for a long time. And I said, whenever I get that, whenever I awaken at night and there's something in my mind, I take it seriously. I either write it down or I remember it the next day. And then I started to think about it. And I started to say, you know what? I think Abraham Lincoln's the best president the United States ever had. I'm going to write a book and prove it. And I did. So then O'Donnell follows up and says, well, where do you think that image of Abraham Lincoln came from? I said, the Holy Spirit. Uh-oh. I thought O'Donnell was going to have a heart attack. I thought she was going to have a heart attack. And so she looks at me and she goes, you talk to God? And I said, yes, Nora. She told me not to do this show. And there was a joke. Okay. But then I said to her, you're Catholic, right? Oh, yeah. I said, don't you understand that the Holy Spirit in our religion
exactly
is the source of all inspiration? Now Nora is in trouble because she's trying to make fun of me. You talk to God, but now I'm into theology. So Nora backs off real fast. But that is absolutely what happened. And I absolutely believe that. I believe that my career has been inspired by something way beyond me. Because Dom, I'm not that smart. Okay? I'm not that smart.
When it comes to branding, when it comes to the nugget, when it comes to when you, I love to be there when you do that, because that's how I would build myself, but I haven't done what you've done with The Killing and the other books. There is a gift there. It is a special gift. And that's why TV was so appropriate for you. You see it, you know it. And this guy Dugard, you know people, you chose the right guy. I mean, this guy brings you stuff. He probably sometimes doesn't even know what he has. You see it, I think, instantly.
Well, it's a great partnership because he does the legwork because I don't have time to do it. I've got, a news agency to run on BillO'Reilly.com. And then he brings that to me and I take it and I craft it into the book you read. But I think that Americans have to understand that you, everybody listening to us right now, have a special gift. And you didn't do anything to get it. It was given to you. And my theology is when you recognize the gift, you have to develop it. It was given to you for a reason. And that's what I've done.
I hope you wrote that book someday, because there's going to be big trouble. I could just see in the climate we're in. Hey, we're taking questions for you, Bill. Guy comes up with one. I have a whole prepared thing, but I'm going to go to the audience with a question. Scott wants to know, which president broke the most Indian treaties? And I thought that was, we see this
coming. Well, U.S. Grant did, because he was in office 8 years.
Right.
And that was the height of the expansion. Okay. Andrew Johnson had no use for the Indians. I mean, it's like Indians, get rid of them. All right. And then Grant came in after Johnson. And Grant was initially very sympathetic, because he knew what Andrew Jackson had done, Trail of Tears. You're taking a huge nation to Cherokees. You're whipping them out to Oklahoma. They didn't know anything about Oklahoma, okay? And you're uprooting all these other tribes. And Grant was sympathetic. But then pressures gold in particular, because the U.S. government is bankrupt. Mm-hmm. They needed the gold in the Black Hills. So they broke all the treaties. So Grant would be the guy. And then that was continued onward after him.
Well, the thing that I enjoy most about the book is how you work in even Abraham Lincoln. So let's go through some of the characters. And the other day, I don't know if you wrote this in the book or intended it, but with me, and I wrote this down because I didn't want to forget, you talked about, we were talking about police brutality, systemic racism, America's a racist country. And you made the observation, and the book proves this, it's very balanced. The policy was not to exterminate Native Americans. There were a lot of things here. It's merciless, these battles. This is as bad or worse than the Japanese book that you wrote, Killing the Rising Sun. But the overall policy was not extermination, right?
In the beginning, it was relocation.
Right.
And if you look at before 1813, because that's where you start, the pilgrims coming over on the Mayflower in the 17th century, they survived only because the Indians of Massachusetts helped them.
Right.
So each tribe was different. And that's what a lot of people don't understand. It's not just Native Americans. There was a huge difference between the Iroquois, who would cut your throat in a second, and the peaceful tribes of the East Coast. Huge. Huge difference between the Comanche, who you didn't want to go anywhere near in Texas, northern Mexico, and Oklahoma, and the Cherokee. The Cherokee, they negotiate with you, all right? They wanted to have peace. Some Native American tribes did not. They were warlike, and they attacked other Native American tribes, all right? That's just what their culture was. So it's a very complex mosaic. And when you hear white supremacist country, I always go, wait. These people forging West, they were white supremacists? They couldn't even read or write. All they were looking for was a plot of land to farm and raise a family in freedom. They didn't even know the Native Americans were out there. They just got in their little wagons, went across the Allegheny Pass, and hoped they get something in Ohio, Indiana, Illinois, and then past the Mississippi as the century unfolded.
John Parker is the archetype of this, the settler, I think, and the stuff he went through, and how I guess one of the daughters was kidnapped in this. So it was merciless on all sides. I mean, it's incredible what happened in each and every battle at the end of the battle.
Because it escalated.
Right.
So John Parker is a guy who wanted freedom. He moves to Texas. There's nobody in Texas. There's very little protection for him. Wasn't a state yet. Who's the power in Texas? The Comanches. All right. The Comanches were so fierce, they drove the Apaches out of Texas completely into New Mexico and Arizona. That's how fierce they were. And the Mexican army wouldn't even fight the Comanches because they took no prisoners, the Comanches. And if they did capture you, they would torture you in ways that are just inconceivable. So anyway, Parker shows up and he gets a big ranch, and the Comanches go, okay, fine. We're going to burn it down, kill you, and take your daughter and another baby captive. And they did. And then the search went on to find the Parker woman, and they eventually found her. The whites did. And she didn't want to come back. She wanted to stay in the Comanche tribe. Eventually, she did come back. But it's an amazing story. And that's why I'm trying to say, look, this is a very volatile time in America, Dom. You know that. I know. That's what we do for a living. But don't buy into the propaganda. These are complicated situations. And when I hear this unbelievable garbage about our country, I'm just compelled to write books like Killing Crazy Horse.
Well, there was, though, manifest. First there was Monroe, the sea deciding sea, and then there's Manifest Destiny, and then there's Andrew Jackson. Your Andrew Jackson captures, I think, that this is a guy you don't want to have a spat with. There's going to be a duel. He's going to horsewhip you, chase you across town. But it's more balanced than I thought when it came to Indians.
Jackson is the closest president to Donald Trump.
Exactly.
I mean, in personality.
Yeah.
And he makes Trump look like Shirley Temple. So if you insulted Jackson, he isn't going to tweet. Jackson, if he were alive today, Jackson wouldn't be tweeting. He would shoot you. Okay? So
a right.
little bit more. But Jackson did have a conscience, and he adopted an Indian boy and raised him as his own after a battle where the boy's family was killed. And he took the boy back to Tennessee and raised him with his wife. Now, that's not saying that Andrew Jackson's the greatest guy of all time. I mean, that's not what I'm trying to say. Jackson was a soldier. He was ordered to defeat the Creek Nation. He did. And it was pretty brutal. And Jackson's a tough guy. He carried two bullets in him. One he was shot in a duel. The other I read about where he was after Thomas Hart Benton. And Benton's brother shot Jackson. Jackson lived, but almost not. So, I mean, these are all in Killing Crazy Horse. And I think I'm successful in giving you an honest picture of all of these legends.
And the number of people, Abraham Lincoln, 1832, 23-year-old Abraham Lincoln makes an appearance. So
Black
the book,
Hawk War.
Yeah, the book has, you know, page after page of the big issues, Custer being the ultimate, but all these big figures in history, Abraham Lincoln jumps in. The guy I wanted to talk about with you, though, was Ulysses S. Grant. Now, I never had any inkling to want to know anything about Grant, but as a result of this and a couple of other things, I find Grant to be a much more fascinating guy in history, probably the history. You taught history. I taught English. Grant was seen as a guy who he just overwhelmed Lee. He was an inferior general. He just threw millions of troops, whatever, and that's how he won. But I see Grant as a much bigger figure historically, and the stuff he negotiated with Indians and tried to do proves that. Your book talks about him in that way.
U.S. Grant was a man, probably more than any other American I've ever seen, who was caught up in circumstances way beyond his control. So he starts in the Mexican War, Polk, the president, provokes Mexico. We get down, kick their butts, and we take all the Southwest and tooling California away from Mexico. Okay, U.S. Grant's in that war. He distinguishes himself. Then he puts himself in the Civil War, ignored. He was way out west. Lincoln didn't know who he was. He's out there, he's smoking his cigars, he's drinking his whiskey. And all of a sudden, Lincoln goes, let's get this guy. All right, I don't know who told Lincoln that Grant would be the general, because Lincoln's generals were terrible, as everybody knows, at the beginning of the Civil War. He gets Grant in, Grant wins the war. All right, and a lot of the times he did what you just said. He had an overwhelming force. He just goes, you guys just run into that town and take it. Boom, a lot of casualties, but he took it. And then Grant becomes president. Now, Grant was way, way out of his league. He wasn't smart enough. He wasn't educated enough. He didn't understand the big picture. And the United States was going bankrupt. The whole economy was collapsing in front of U.S. Grant.
Mm-hmm.
All of a sudden, Custer reports back that there's gold in the Black Hills, lots of it. And the U.S. government says, we need that gold to pay off our debt so we don't go bankrupt. So we're going to break all the treaties with the Sioux and take the gold. And that's what happened. And then the Sioux weren't real thrilled with that opera. So they started attacking the army. And Crazy Horse beat them every single time because Crazy Horse was a brilliant military commander. Wasn't the chief of the Sioux. Sitting Bull was. But Sitting Bull never fought in a battle, much like Dwight Eisenhower, the supreme commander of the Allied forces in World War II, never fought in a battle, as I chronicle in Killing Patton. So Crazy Horse has beaten the army time after time after time and beaten them bad. And Grant was going, whoa, I got to get Crazy George Custer out there, who Grant knew from Gettysburg. Custer had distinguished himself there in that battle. So he brings Custer out. Custer's got the suede jacket, the little red cravat, the flowing blonde hair. And he's like this, you know? And he thinks it's going to be pretty easy to beat Crazy Horse. Well, didn't turn out that way.
Absolutely. Why this book now? Why did you end up at this point? You have these things in your mind, they're churning. But why this big book now that's such a lengthy period of time? How do you choose the killing thing at the right time?
Well, we postponed this book because we wrote the United States of Trump, because I had to write a history book about Trump. And still to this day, I'll submit, you want to know about Donald Trump and why he does what he does, you read this book, you're going to know. It's not pro, not con. So I had Crazy Horse ready to go about 18 months ago. And then we said, first we'll put Trump out, then we'll put Crazy Horse out. In the meantime, in that 18-month slot, the rise of the far left in America to demonize our country as a white supremacist nation that's been evil from the jump is what the New York Times is putting out. Evil from conception. That's the United States. So I said, wait a minute. That's not true. All right? All you got to do is read Killing Lincoln. You know that's not true. Or Killing England. But the Indian Wars were so important to the structure of this country now.
Exactly.
All right. I got to get this thing out. And so we did. So I see myself as the gatekeeper for American tradition.
That's how I always saw you too. The folks, it's traditional. It's not conservative. It's traditional America. That's what it's about. That's under attack. And you were on with me a couple of years ago. You talked about what they're after, not the monuments and all the smarter ones. They're after the Constitution, ultimately. If they can take the Constitution away, shred that, weaken that, there's no defense against anything that the left wants to do.
It's really a very, very clever plan that is being submitted in front of the American people. 90% of us don't understand what's really happening here. And it's being driven by race. So the Black Lives Matter movement has been around for a long time. I hit them in 2016. That's how long, 4 years ago. I said, this crew, they're Marxists. And they admit it. They're not hiding.
Right.
All right? They're a Marxist crew. You keep your eye on them. They want racial unrest. They want it. Because that's going to advance their hypothesis that America is an evil nation. We got to change everything. So you see it. So you can't have Thomas Jefferson or James Madison or Benjamin Franklin or George Washington. You can't have them anymore. They're gone. Why? Because they own slaves. And anybody who owned slaves back in the 19th century is canceled, disqualified. And the press once resisted this kind of real extreme left-wing politics. Doesn't any longer. So they got the New York Times, the Washington Post, NBC News, and CNN on their side. They all know that Black Lives Matter global organization is Marxist. They'll never tell you. But the ultimate run is, and this is Bernie Sanders, Ocasio-Cortez, all of these people, the ultimate run is knock out capitalism. Knock it out. We don't want that, all right? We want to take private property, which they absolutely do, and give it to the poor people because the poor people were exploited from the jump. That's the end game. And they're making progress.
The world of sports, you're a sports guy, I think football probably too. Are you surprised at that? You know a lot of sports media people. Listeners should know Alex Trebek, who I never knew. You have a lot of fondness for him. You talked about Trebek one of the times I've had you on recently. How about in the sports world? Does it surprise you, and particularly some of the bigger like Acostas, I've always thought was a blowhard, but surprise you what's going on with sports.
No, because it's peer pressure. So in the National Football League, it's 70% African Americans on the field. In the NBA, I think it's 90%. All right? So these are individuals of varying intelligence. All right? Some of them are just stone cold stupid. All they've done all their life is shoot a basketball or throw a football. They don't know anything. But there are leaders. LeBron James, all right? Colin Kaepernick, not really a leader, but a guy who is so radical and hates his country so much, he was able to get a lot of attention doing that. So the peer pressure on the players to conform to America as a racist country is enormous. And you saw it with Drew Brees. Drew Brees doesn't think America is a racist country. I know Drew Brees. He's a good guy. He doesn't think America's, but what is he going to do? Mm-hmm. Most of his teammates are black, and they do think America's a racist country. So Breeze has got to go, you know, I can't fracture the whole locker room with, you know, opposing political points of view about race. And that's what's happened. So it's all fallen into line. But you're seeing the backlash, Dom, because the owners of the teams are going to lose hundreds of millions of dollars. Because people aren't going to buy the merchandise. They're not going to go to the games and buy the $6 hot dogs and the $10 beers because they're teed off as well they should be. When you kneel or don't come out of the locker room or do anything else, you are disrespecting the flag and the anthem. You can protest. I'm a protester. I protest all the time about stuff, but I don't disrespect my country. And we
How's that project going? We're a little bit off field, but how's that project going that you came on with?
Tremendous.
Talking about traditional America. That's the thing that's misunderstood, Bill. Right there. I'm glad you have it. Right. Tell us. We have people tonight that may not know about it.
This is a yard sign. Our campaign is stand up for your country. We don't kneel. So I say, look, you see a Black Lives Matter yard sign. There are a lot of them. Put this yard sign up. Now, this isn't political. This isn't a negative on anybody. This is saying, I think my country is noble, and I'm going to stand up for my country. I know it needs to be improved. Absolutely needs to be improved. Okay? But I'm not kneeling. So the Stand Up for Your Country campaign, which we launched on BillO'Reilly.com, phenomenal. Phenomenal. And people have had enough of their country being insulted.
Let's go back to the book, because that, again, is a subtext of the book. I'm not sure if you were thinking about it or you maybe were. You wanted to tell this gigantic story, but it comes back to, again, this is fair treatment. The book says the merciless Indian Wars. It doesn't say on one side or the, both sides. It's fair to Native Americans, Indians. I haven't seen any Indian Native American group go after you on the book and say inaccurate, stereotypical. It's balanced. But it doesn't say that we set out to just murder Native Americans, as you would hear in most revisionist history today.
Because that's not true. Right. Congress actually passed a law in the early part of the 19th century forbidding white people from settling west of the Mississippi. That was a law. Of course, nobody could enforce it because there was nobody out there, no law to enforce it. And the settlers, there were so many of them, just pushed and pushed and pushed west. But it wasn't by design. They didn't get a little room and say, hey, we're going to wipe all these people out. That's not how it went down. So when you see O'Reilly do a campaign, stand up for your country, write a book, Killing Crazy Horse, Killing Lincoln, Killing England, what you're going to get is a fact-based approach. I back up what I say, Don. And that's why I've been successful for all of these years. You can disagree with me all day long. But if LeBron James debated me, who do you think is going to win that debate?
Yeah, when we get to specifics, the left goes away. It's these vague nostrums about America. Wanted to talk about just a cavalcade of the figures that show up here before we get to Custer, Bill. I noted even 1855, Secretary of War Jefferson Davis creates the cavalry. You know, and there's not enough room in the book, but these figures all are here. I didn't know
I crammed in everybody. Why
I didn't know Jefferson Davis was Secretary of War.
Oh, you didn't? No.
No.
He, you know, all the South, Robert E. Lee and all the people we're demonizing now, Stonewall Jackson, Jefferson Davis, they were all in the fabric of the United States. But what they did was they surrendered their national loyalty to state loyalty. That was a huge mistake. I'm not loyal to New York in the sense that I'm a New Yorker, but my loyalty is to the United States of America. And my grandfather was a hero in World War I at Meuse Argonne, and my father, who was in the Pacific Theater in World War II, they weren't over there for New York. They were over there for the United States. So that's what happened to those Southern guys. But in killing Crazy Horse, we bring in all of the titans of the 18th century, 19th century. We tell you, here's what their role was. Here's what they did. But the most fascinating part of the book are the Indians themselves, because we took those profiles from Native American history, not from white history. So we were able to get a hold of the Native American reportage of Custer's Last Stand, because there wasn't any white reportage. They were all dead. And what happened was the Indians had an oral tradition, a very disciplined oral tradition that they would pass down, because that's what they did at night. They talked about lore, L-O-R-E, and their tribes and what had happened in the past. And then as they assimilated more with the white culture, they started to write it down. And that's what Dugard got. He got it all from the Native American point of view. And they had no reason to lie. They had no reason to exaggerate or anything. They were telling the stories, both good and bad.
That's well, that brings us, that brings us to Cochise. And the word I might use for him, I guess, is cosmopolitan. You drill down a lot. I always thought Geronimo is the star. What do I know? You know, I don't have the background in this. But Cochise, the spirituality, the cleverness, the bigger than life, the way he seemed with the other Indian tribes, not just because of his prowess in war and all that, but there's something there that's important to know about.
We put you in the teepee. I don't know if I can say teepee anymore, but we put you in the teepee when Cochise is negotiating with the young U.S. Army lieutenant about a cessation of hostilities. Cochise was never defeated by the U.S. Army. Crazy Horse, of course, in the end was. But Cochise was never defeated. Big strapping guy, all right? Charismatic. The Native Americans in Arizona and Southwest flocked to him. When he died of natural causes. Nobody knows where he's buried. He's like an Egyptian pharaoh. They took his body into the canyon. Nobody ever knew where they laid it to this day. So we introduce you to Cochise, his family, and his personality, and how he did what he did. And that's what makes my books different, because these become real people to you. And to me, I mean, I'm rereading my book for the fourth time now, Dom, because I want to get all the facts and everything straight for the massive amount of interviews I'm doing. And I'm just going, boy, you know, like that four times, because there's so much. And but it's really, I think, a service to the world to know not a mythology, but a real person. And that's what we do to all of the Indian chiefs.
Is there any Western that you think comes close to what you found in writing this? I mean, how many Westerns? 1,000 of them,
million,
or more.
Right, right.
Yeah. I mean, I see at the end of Tombstone, for example, they talk about Wyatt Earp and how he went to a movie set. He was the guide on the movie set. He lived into the early part of the century. Is there one that you think comes anywhere near what it was like? You don't go the dead. You don't go the Deadwood. All that Deadwood is mentioned in here.
Yeah, we go up to the Black Hills and extensively. But the best Indian cowboy movie, if you want to just categorize it that way, are The Searchers with John Wayne, because that is the movie based on the Parker family and the kidnapping of the Parker girl, the young daughter. And that is pretty authentic. And you see just how you know, rough the Comanches were and how difficult it was to track them down. So I would say The Searchers is a movie that you might want to watch if you're very interested in it. There are other films that most of the time Hollywood just glamorizes certain things. But here's something very interesting. There was fake news back in the 19th century. And the fake news was in the Eastern newspapers, like in Philadelphia, New York, Boston. Right. All right. Those newspapers demonized Native Americans, just calling them savages and they're illiterate this. They don't know anything. They're gross. That's what was printed in the nation's newspapers. And that's what people thought. And when I got out there to a Chief Joseph, brilliant man, even William Weatherford, he was educated in Philadelphia. He was the Creek chief, all right? William Weatherford. And he's half white and half Creek, and he decided to lead his tribe. So it was much more than the fake news of the 19th century was portraying. Custer took two journalists with him when he tried to track down Crazy Horse. I was hoping they would be for the New York Times, but they weren't. They were in it from a Dakota
probably New York Post, yeah.
No, it was a North Dakota paper. Well, yeah. Those guys never came back. But he took them because he knew they would write the story of Custer versus Crazy Horse, that Custer was a hero and Crazy Horse was a barbarian. He knew it.
Got a question from our listeners, Bill. And I do remember something in a book on this, but the power of the railroads and that expansion. You know, sometimes it seems to be in the Westerns, the railroads are seen as they just came along because they were expanding. I read other books. They were the driving force. And there was a viciousness with the railroads. It was unbelievable.
What happened was before the Civil War, there were battles, but nothing major. All right? There were more skirmishes. Then a Civil War breaks out. And all the U.S. Army troops, the Union troops are called back. So the Indians had a respite of 3 or 4 years where nobody was chasing them. Nobody was bothering them. They could do whatever they wanted to do. All right. When the war was over, this transcontinental railroad had been completed. Under Lincoln, it had been completed. So you could take a train from Washington to San Francisco. Mm-hmm. Once that happened, all of the hardened Union troops that had won the war against the South got on those trains heading west with their cannon and their guns and an attitude. So before, you had to ride thousands of miles to get to fight the battles. Now you sat on a train. That was the turning point and the beginning of the end for the Native American tribes.
Now, you put him on the cover, even with all these big figures. Let's drill down on Custer. And what I was impressed with is your reporting on how big this entourage, you mentioned the reporters, the stuff he took when he was going into the Black Hills. This guy was beyond branding Custer. It wasn't just the personal appearance. Everything about him was creating the myth.
Yes, and his wife was a big part of that. So Custer brings his wife, Elizabeth, out to Kansas. That was his base, right? Leavenworth, Fort Leavenworth. And then he's ordered by Grant to go into the Black Hills to see how much gold there is. And he goes and he sees and he reports back a lot of gold. And Grant says, well, I think we're going to take it. And then Custer says, well, Crazy Horse isn't going to like that. Mm-hmm. And Grant goes to take care of him. Okay. And that's how it started. But he was vainglorious, George Custer. He was an egomaniac, but he was a very courageous general. Too courageous, because he was almost foolhardy in the way he tried to invade Crazy Horse's camp and then figured out there were a lot more warriors than he thought. And then his backup were too afraid to come help him, Benteen and Reno. And they were tried for cowardice. Now, they could have saved Custer, because Custer split his force into threes, but two-thirds of his force didn't want any part of Crazy Horse, and they stayed away while Custer was slaughtered.
Nice little tabloid stuff there, too. The letters, the love letters, et cetera, with his wife. Didn't want them falling into enemy hands. Too raunchy.
Yeah, I mean, George was, if any general ever beside Patton, should be a Hollywood icon, it's Custer. I mean, he had it all going on, and he had his brother with him. his brother-in-law, his cousin, all dead. And, you know, look, do I feel sorry for George Custer? In a way, I do. I mean, nobody likes to see that. In fact, Custer himself was the only body on the battlefield not mutilated. Crazy Horse gave orders to his warriors, don't touch him. Leave him intact. Everybody else mutilated, not Custer, because Crazy Horse respected Custer.
Did not know that either. So, Bill, let's talk about the other day you were on the show and you talked about the upcoming debates. You've never done it. They wouldn't let you do a presidential debate, right? I mean, it's pretty obvious. Either side would not want that. But you've been the moderator. You can handicap that. You've interviewed presidents. Particularly, we talk all the time, the difficulty of interviewing President Obama. He filibusters like nobody else, and it's a president and interrupting. You believe, and I do, that Chris Wallace is going to be going for his legacy. He's certainly not going to appear to be in the tank going after Trump. Seeing Trump in Philadelphia last night, he can handle Chris Wallace. He's going to get bloody too. But can Biden do that? What you said Biden's going to do a rope-a-dope. He's just not going to answer the question.
Yeah, not going to answer. Look, it's really a phony situation. And all Americans should understand what it is. So they bill it as a presidential debate. But the structure of the debate is that the moderator, and the first one will be Chris Wallace, as you mentioned, gets to ask a question. And it could be the toughest question you can think of. But the candidate gets to answer uninterrupted for 90 seconds. So I could ask any question in the world, Dom. They don't have to answer it, and they won't.
Right.
So you'll ask Trump, well, on May 12th, you said this about COVID, and then on August 15th, you said the exact opposite. What's the deal? And then Trump will go for 90 seconds, I did the greatest job in the world on COVID. That's going to answer the question. Wallace can't interrupt him. Now, Wallace can follow up and say, you didn't really answer the question. Do you want another crack at it? And Trump will go, yeah, I did the greatest job at COVID. What are you talking about? See? So you're never going to get an O'Reilly one-on-one with Obama where I did interrupt him. And I apologize for it, but I went, Mr. President, I got to get you back on track here. And when I interviewed Trump, I did exactly the same thing. And you can Google him and watch him. Now, for Biden, Biden's going to do the same exact thing. All right. He's going to also ask him, hey, what's the matter with you? You do this. You don't come out of your bed. And then Biden's going to go off into global warming or how Trump is responsible for everybody dying from COVID. Biden's going to answer what he wants to answer. The trick is for Trump, because Biden, I don't think, is capable of doing this. What Trump has to do is answer Wallace's question. I'd try to answer it if I were Trump. And then turn to Biden and go, you know, Joe, there's something bothering me about this whole thing. And then do what he did to Jeb Bush. Do what he did to Ted Cruz. What Trump did. Trump wiped those guys out on the stage. But Wallace's not going to have much control over it. And people need to know that.
Is there anything you can do? Or you're going to hold that until right before the debate when we have you back on?
Yeah, I mean, I'll give you a pretty good idea of where to go for the good of the American people in a debate. But I can tell you with 100% certainty, neither candidate is going to answer the questions. They're going to say what they've been told to say, what they've been rehearsed to say. And that's what's going to happen.
We often talk, look, we're in the business and we believe it, but it's a bit of hype. This is the most important election of our lifetime. You know, we may have said that in 2008 because President Obama was so different and there was a fear how progressive he is. And I think he was very progressive. Got to say, though, just seeing in the last couple of days, it's a Freudian slip. I didn't make too much of it. Harris saying the Harris-Biden ticket, Biden saying the Harris-Biden ticket. But there's definitely something up with Joe Biden. And it's obvious.
I'm just happy that Biden knows who's running with him.
Yeah.
I wasn't convinced he even knew. Look, I can mock Joe Biden all day long. It's not hard to do. I've known him for a while. I ran into him at the correspondence dinner. I said, hey, your boss interviewed with me 3 times. How about an interview, Mr. Vice President? He goes, I'm never going to interview with you, O'Reilly. You're doing fine without me. And he laughed. He knows he couldn't come up against me. But now he's a different guy. And if you watch his performance in Michigan, where he's talking about COVID in the military, It's frightening. And I'm not exaggerating. He did not know what he was saying. The nominee for the Democratic Party spoke about COVID in the military, and there wasn't one word that was accurate or made any sense at all, and he didn't even know it. Look, when you and I make mistakes, Dom, we know it. We hear it and then correct it. Sometimes we misspeak and have to correct it later. But we know if it's gobbledygook. He doesn't know. That being said, and this is an important point, my book, Killing Reagan, chronicled how Reagan's mental acuity declined after he was almost killed. And there were days when he could not function as president. Nobody knew it. They kept it quiet. You didn't have the internet back then. You didn't have all of this intrusion. But Reagan made a miraculous comeback from his mental problems brought on by the assassination attempt. Biden could do that. So people who think that it's going to be Joe drooling at the podium on September 29th may be in for a shock. But if you rattle him, if Trump can rattle Biden, that's when it's going to all fall apart. You got to get his rehearsed answers out of his ear. Now, Biden may be trying to do that to Trump. He should be. But I don't know if he's capable of it or not.
Out of all the people, the most combative interviews, who was the favorite? I'll tell you mine to get what I was always wanted to ask you. Governor Christie was on with me 8 or 9 times, right? It was a big get back then when he was governor. And I got on him when he went too far with Obama before the 2012 election. He came out of the blocks with me. I saw that guy on his feet, Bill. It was in a moment. I felt as if I were in heaven to have somebody like that come back at me. It felt alive. How about you? Was there anybody where you ever felt, boy, this is good. I'm loving this.
Trump.
Oh, yeah.
I interviewed Trump more than anyone. All right. And boy, I gave it to him. On that John McCain thing,
right.
I just hit him right between the eyes. And Trump, you never knew how he was going to react to this. Sometimes he was logical and sometimes he wasn't. So the Trump interviews were the high wire. Obama was different. He was more intellectual. Obama wasn't going to lose control or let emotion take over. Sometimes I could get a straight answer out of him, and sometimes I couldn't. George Bush, the younger, was circumspect, very cautious. But I remember one time I hit him. I said, "You're getting killed. You, President Bush, are getting killed by the press. Don't you feel an obligation to fight back on behalf of the people who admire you and voted for you?" Mm-hmm. I thought that was a pretty tough question. And he goes to me, "Factor, I just don't pay attention." That was it.
You know, that's the best way to end these with you. I write these down. The last time we were in person together with you, I wanted to ask you about your son, the actor. You did a spot on Sean Connery. Tell him it's about the dance. You won't believe the number of people that still bring that up when O'Reilly imitated Sean O'Connor. How's your son doing?
He is running for class president. He's a senior in high school. And I've designed his campaign slogan.
Okay.
You ready?
Yes.
Vote for Spencer. He feels your pain. Tapping into the teenage angst. Get little buttons. He feels your pain.
Perfect.
I think he's going to win a landslide. I mean, oh, Spencer feels my pain.
Perfect. Perfect. Bill, congratulations on another great book. It's available all over the place. And for our listeners, Joseph Fox of a bookshop by visiting josephfoxbookshop.com. We always send people there. They are great. Spectacular. I can hardly wait to talk to you on the radio again soon when we get to the big debate. Maybe you'll divulge the secret of what can be done by the moderator. Bill, thank you. Your friendship, the great work that you do. And thank you most of all for giving me stuff where I go. How did he find that? I thought I knew a lot about this. That's what these books are about to me.
Your audience should know it's always a pleasure to talk with you. You're an honest guy, a straight shooter. Love you, Dom. Thanks for having me.
Thank you, Bill. Thanks very much. All right, Bill O'Reilly, and of course, all this good stuff is brought to us by Malamud and Associates Attorneys at Law, LLC. Visit them online at malamudlaw.com. Thanks, everybody. Thanks to Dan, who put together this elaborate setup in the Dom Dome here tonight. Thanks to Spike Eskin, Greg Stocker, Walter Koss, and thank you that we can do something like this and bring you people like Bill O'Reilly. Congratulations again, Bill. Thanks, everyone. Have a great night. See you tomorrow at 9 o'clock.
Dom Giordano, weekdays 9 till noon on Talk Radio 1210 WPHT.
T-Mobile has invested billions to light up America's largest 5G network, from big cities to small towns, including right here in yours. And great coverage is just the beginning. Right now, families and small businesses can save up to 20% versus AT&T and Verizon when they switch. Visit your local T-Mobile store today.
Plan savings with 3 lines of T-Mobile Essentials versus comparable available plans. Plan features and taxes and fees may vary.